There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister, how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Australia is back on track.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
Just dumbstruck.
I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
I don't think I know.
I have no hesitation.
That should cause great concern.
Just sit down with
it. I'm sick of your lies.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant.
He needs a mirror.
I mean,
oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Taste of democracy. Very good.
G'day, Mark Kenny here from the ANU's Australian Studies Institute, and I'm joined, as is nearly always the case, by my friend and colleague Dr. Maria Taflaga, political scientist, lecturer and director of the Centre for the Study of Australian Politics. Hi there, Maria.
Hello. Hello, everyone.
Now, as we speak, it's just days to the federal budget, and this one has a pretty Herculean task to perform, at least politically, that is, repolling the collapsed circus tent that is the 9-year-old Morrison coalition government. It is such a strange set of economic circumstances too that it finds itself in: gargantuan debt, deficits as far as the eye can see, a lingering pandemic, a dangerous European war in which China is being implicated so that our chest-beating PM can flag trade sanctions against Beijing in the future, wages losing out to rising inflation, rising interest rates, labour shortages, floods, and of course an election to fight. To help us grapple with all of that is Peter Martin AM, economist, broadcaster, business and economy editor at The Conversation, and no stranger to the sausage. Now, Peter, I suspect you probably don't want "no stranger to the sausage" written on your headstone later on in life.
No, thank you. No, especially not being a vegetarian.
Well, it could be a vegetarian sausage. I mean, this is a broad term these days, a broad church.
Well, let's face it, the vegetarian sausage they haven't really mastered.
Yes, they that. Have. They're better.
No, it's
a recipe for gas.
Shall we discuss this first?
There's many good vegetarian products, but I just...
The ones I don't like, Maria, are the ones that are like sausages.
Oh,
but those
that.
Other ones that have got the herbs and the chickpeas in them,
yeah,
they
I imagine
are,
that would be quite good.
Unrealism is fine. There are people who think that vegetarians want stuff that tastes like meat that bleeds, and
well, that's because
they don't.
That's because you get the,
exactly.
You remember that whole range of products like not bacon and not chicken and stuff,
were awful too.
Yeah, and they weren't bacon and they weren't good either. I think that was – I mean, I had a few of them and they seemed to me to be a recipe for gastric reflux, like heartburn.
Well,
they're not digestible, I suspect.
At the risk of being non-political in a politics podcast, I'm wearing my vegan leather shoes and with a vegan leather belt.
I can't compete with that.
That's very political. I mean,
consistent.
That's identity politics, and according
it
to some,
not.
It is destroying
it,
this
it is.
Country.
It is consistency. It is about if you're gonna care about animals. I didn't think we were gonna discuss this today.
What are we going to discuss? It is happening. It is happening.
Look, I think this is an interesting segue into some complex and difficult decisions that the government
moral
has
questions.
To make.
Yeah,
yes,
that's
about,
right.
It's about balancing the trade-offs between winning an election and the reality of the budget and economic unique, or not unique, but definitely un, un, we haven't experienced this kind of set of economic circumstances for many decades.
Well, that's right. And so tightening the vegan belt might be the metaphor for the budget, or loosening it, or whatever it's going to be. Usually they loosen belts before elections and try and tell us they're tightening them whilst they dish out the dough. And there's a bit of dough washing around already. But before we even go to all of that, what I want to do with you two excellent minds is just have a bit of a chat about South Australia in terms of its federal implications and, you know, what actually happened there. And Peter, you and I are both native South Australians.
And we were both listening, listening in my case, probably watching in yours on the night. The concession speech given by Stephen Marshall, the Premier, one-term Premier now, South Australia, was, I'd be interested to know what do you think, as well, Maria, almost a perfect example of the genre. What he did, he said, this is a wonderful day. We have all voted. We have all made our decision. And then he said, and, you know, there are good people on the other side. They'll do well. He observed inter alia, and perhaps gratuitously, that on both sides, he came from a strong Labor family.
Yeah.
This is the Liberal
outgoing Liberal Premier.
Liberal Premier. And these people will do well. South Australia is in good hands. I was thrilled beyond belief. And then the speech of the incoming Premier was, if it was possible, even better.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting because one of the things he said in that speech, this is Stephen Marshall, was that, which really sort of jangled with me a bit. It was good. I agree with you. It was a really good speech. I just think it was deficient in one area, and that really came to me when he sort of reached his apotheosis when he said, and I have never been more confident and optimistic about South Australia than I am right now. And I thought, so hang on. You've just been kicked out. At that stage, it looked like he might be losing his seat. He hadn't said a single word about whose fault it was that he'd led his party after just one term to a defeat. And whilst I know that it was good to be very optimistic and to celebrate democracy in action and it was very South Australian in a sense. I noticed Van Badham, for example, among a number of people, made the comment that the South Australian election seemed so much more civilised.
We're nice.
Yeah, and it is. It's, as I always say to people, it's the central state with a centrist political culture, and that is a it is a more civilised place in that regard. It's less extreme, less open to that kind of useless hostility that we see characterising politics elsewhere, and in fact even operating within the parties elsewhere, although there's no doubt that the divisions inside the Liberal Party in South Australia are famously long, you know, deep and long-reaching, and Marshall was torn down in a sense by divisions inside his party. In fact,
he could well say, look, you know, if he was to observe what went wrong, he could say, well, you know, I was the captain of the boat.
Yeah.
People in it weren't exactly rowing all at the right
time. That's right. And a couple of them jumped out, or the police sort of required them to leave as they faced charges for this or that. So, yes, that was pretty difficult. But he and Vicky Chapman, the deputy leader, were pretty much despised by the right of the party. You know, this is the same party that produced Bernardi and used to be led by Nick Minchin, and which has Senator Antic in it now, you know, very, very conservative, very religiously conservative and hard line. So there's that element to it. So I suppose when I was asked the other day, you know, what happened, and I thought about what I should have said after I said whatever it was that I did say, the pithiest way I could put it was, you know, we had a good government has lost its way, Julia Gillard's famous explanation for taking over after Rudd. Well, I think in the South Australian case, it was a divided government lost its base.
Yes, but also I think the key thing that matters for states, and now I think matters federally, given that we've had, you know, floods, Ukraine, COVID. The key thing that matters for states, the only thing that they will punish you for is not delivering services.
Yeah, that's a good point.
We employ them to do things for us. And yes, maybe if they're ideological one way or the other, we'll forgive them for that. But if they can't get hospitals working, if they open the state, the borders at exactly the wrong time, when
Omicron happened,
We don't forgive them for that. And it was yes. So why did Marshall lose in South Australia? lots of people I know think he's a really great guy, you know, they still think that, they made a few mistakes that affected people's lives. Now, that's traditionally been a state thing, I think, which is why people vote in Labor governments who are on the whole believe in providing services, so they're usually better at it. Traditionally been a state thing. I think increasingly it's becoming a federal thing.
Well, the feds think they can do it. The feds think they can do it, don't they, Maria?
I mean, they don't have a chance.
That's right. We've seen them.
Defence is the only absolute thing they have to themselves, and they're not always good at that.
There've been a number of celebrated cases where the feds, Maria, have been, you know, eager to do services. We saw it with the vaccine rollout, for example. They sort of inveigled their way into that, wanting to, you know, to, because that was meant to be the good bit of the pandemic. You know, the states were doing all the restrictions and all that, all the unpopular stuff, and then the feds were going to roll in with this fantastic, you know, great sort of corrective, the great cure, but then they buggered it up.
So I very much enjoyed listening to your guys' views, because I'm not South Australian, but I do think that South Australia's place is often overlooked, I guess, in our conception of Australia, and it is actually quite unique and ought to be celebrated more. I mean, South Australia is like a pioneer across so many different liberal kind of initiatives, like the right for unions to form, for women to vote, for Indigenous people to vote. Just off the top of my head,
the way we own houses is in fact South Australian. Torrens Title Australia into a nation of homeowners. Yeah,
oh, there you go.
Yeah, they developed a few things.
Yeah, they certainly did. But I do broadly agree, right, that you know, you've sort of got this problem in the Liberal Party, which is increasingly drawing members from a much narrower, more conservative segment of the population, which doesn't necessarily match with its voter base. And we have compulsory voting, so it's not a mobilization game here, right? So that's a massive dilemma for the Liberal Party to kind of manage. And this is happening across several states. You know, it's a long-standing tradition in South Australia for it to be hyperly factionalized, but you can see this happening in Victoria, and the dispute going on in New South Wales still to this day, you know, with the court cases and all of that, is absolutely the same issue again. And, you know, so one kind of trivial way of viewing it is it's just a sort of return to type, you know, that like South Australia is a Labor state and it's returned to type. But I think what you guys were saying about service provision is very interesting. And I just came out of a seminar just now, the ANU poll results, looking at it over aggregate since basically the bushfires in 2019. And two or three findings out of that I think are kind of relevant and interesting to this conversation. And the first one was that Australia's views in what the role of government should be have effectively remained very stable, even though we have had bushfires, cataclysmic floods, and, you know, pestilence basically through COVID-19, which suggests that actually the fact that these views are stable, right, that we have these disasters and people's views about what the government should do doesn't really change that much, suggests that it is actually a core value that we have as Australians, right? Disasters don't make us think any more or any less that the role of government in domains such as healthcare, borders, you know, environmental damage, remain stable. And I guess that is one of the reasons why the Morrison government has potentially struggled, because, you know, that data also showed basically a sort of kind of like an upside down U, right? Like very low trust during the bushfires. It improved enormously over COVID. And once the vaccine rollout started to unravel as well. Mm. Yeah, to not roll out. Exactly. Its trust really unraveled. And the data revealed a similar shape for the states, except the difference is the starting point for the states versus the federal government was about 15%, right? And so
that's,
you know,
higher, right?
Yeah, so people had less trust in the federal government. It rose to a less high peak than the state government, and it is now lower than state governments, right? So it's a similar shape. So obviously people's faith in both federal and state governments has gone on under the same journey. It's just that they trust the federal government absolutely less.
State governments are in people's lives, aren't they, in a much more
exactly.
For the reason that Peter said, you know, they're actually providing services, police, education, roads, health, you know, these sorts of things. And so state governments need to be close to their electorate.
Yes,
or else they go the way of Marshall, which is pretty quickly.
Or Morrison, perhaps, because the federal government has, if you like, tried to become a state government.
Yeah.
Not only under Morrison, you know, famously under Rudd, right? You know, trying to – and Howard before him. You
and
know,
Howard
took over
great
a hospital,
centralizer.
Right? In Tasmania.
Yeah, I was there. I actually travelled on the plane with him to that was it Merseyside?
That's right. Yeah, Mersey Hospital. You know, the idea was that we were going to do it because we're better at it. And then Rudd tried it. And so it used to be, I think you could say that through, say, the Howard years and before that people wanted services and they voted for services at the state level. At the federal level, they voted for lower taxes, right? And
basically.
Of course, the two are in conflict, but it didn't matter because you could vote for services and you could vote for lower tax. Now the feds are getting so much into services that they're being judged on performance as well as low tax.
Yeah, and that's not going to be a happy judgment for the most part because they don't do services well and they sort of cock it up.
No hope. I'd be interested, Maria.
But they used to be able to do this.
When?
Sorry.
When could the feds provide services?
I'm talking about a long time ago, like, you know, 30 years ago, 50, 60 years ago, right? Yeah.
That's not that long.
Because it's right. You're right. Right. The point you guys made about hollowing out is exactly the case. You know, like the federal health bureaucracy, for example, are policy advisors. They formulate policy directions.
As opposed to deliver things,
as
we found out again.
They don't run a single hospital, right? Yeah.
Or vaccinations or rat tests, right?
Yeah. And the public service has lost a lot of capacity to engage in policy thinking as well, because so much of it is kind of contracted out. You know, if you look at the diagram of contracting out from 2010 to today, I think it's almost doubled, right? And so, and when this sort of phenomena of contracting out kind of began in the early 90s, it's less damaging because your contractor used to be a public servant.
Yeah.
And so they had a lot of knowledge and capacity, and there were still lots of public servants in the bureaucracy who had the skills to be able to look at a tender or look at the stuff that comes out of a consulting firm and say, this is garbage. And I think increasingly there is a lack of capability in some of parts of the bureaucracy to be able to look at some of this stuff and say, this is garbage.
Well, look at the Leppington Triangle thing. I mean, they pay $30 million for a $3 million piece of land.
Near the Western Sydney Airport, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the incompetence of that or straight out corruption, whatever it is or both, who knows? It's never really been properly explained. The money was never recovered. That's a staggering failure.
Oh, but we all voted it before, so it's okay.
Yeah, but also it's again what I said about the states. It's that even at the federal level, the things you're talking about, Labor tends to believe in government, and that what makes it difficult for the coalition to, you know, develop policy or maybe outsource to, you know, think it's fine to outsource to someone in a accounting firm or something, is that they don't really believe in government. Now, this mightn't matter if they deliver lower taxes. And that's what I was going to ask about, Maria. What is if the ANU has asked about this, the view about taxes at the moment? The long-term history is that taxes used to be number one concern for people, and in the 90s, beginning of the 90s, that really changed and health overtook it. If you ask people what matters to them taxes, their own personal finances aren't that important, which is, I think, a function of us both getting richer, so it doesn't quite matter as much, and getting older. You're more concerned about services. And yet this government, you will find out more on the budget, on Tuesday, has been selling itself on, we will cut taxes. I don't think that cuts it anymore, but maybe it does.
Well, it's cost of living, isn't it, really, now?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. And I think actually they'll deliver, well, they've more or less said they'll deliver things to address that or to try and address
it. The most recent polling I've seen on that, and I think Resolve had some polling on this recently, or one of the, I remember reading it in the Nine newspapers anyway, recent polling showing that cost of living had shot to number one again, which is not surprising.
As it should.
Well, you know, when you're looking at fuel prices and these sorts of things, yeah.
Bread prices, wheat prices, up 25%.
Sorry, Maria, I think I cut you off then.
Oh, that's okay. So they did not present data on, I guess, what that traditional kind of issues matrix, but less than 50% of Australians think that it is the government's job to keep prices down, but it wasn't that much below 50%, and that measure kind of bounces around. I think the only other really interesting finding out of what was presented that I can remember was that statistically significant numbers of women think that the role of government is important, and that is, you know, that has remained constant over time, because this survey, the ANU poll, uses panel data, which means that you go back to the same group of people. So it's different to, say, the Australian Electoral Study, which is a different random sample every time, or a poll, which is a different random sample.
Yeah, so it's kind of got a longitudinal quality to it.
Yes, so it means that you can actually compare more readily, like how people's views of disasters, for example, are changing,
because
you've got
opinions.
The same.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's got a lot of kind of potential there. And so that is actually something that it's the only demographic feature that seems to have any statistical power over time. Is being female means that your view about the role of government being important and being significant does not shift.
And doesn't change as you age. That's what you
yes,
put
so
there.
that fell out
what about
across the panel.
What
data.
About people generally? Do they become more conservative as they age, as is often
yeah,
said?
Yeah, generally they do. Yes, that's a well-established finding in the voting behaviour.
Resist, I say, resist.
Now, well, it's mostly because they got money, right? And
yeah, that's
assets,
right. They suddenly
and they're invested
got,
in the current system and, like, you
that's
don't want
right.
to change,
and when,
right?
When you've yeah. lived in, as we see, you know, when people have lived in the system all their lives, they start defending it. They have a stake in it. As you say, they
Precisely.
Build up assets within it and so forth.
It's very
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll actually talk about the budget, as you mentioned, Peter, coming up in only a few days' time. And it was originally what we were going to talk about here, but we've had such a lovely chat about all these other things. So back in just a moment.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, we were talking before about a range of things, and cost of living came up. And as I said to you before in the introduction, Peter, you know, we've got debt and deficits as far as the eye can see. We've got the pandemic. We've got a lot of other things happening, global security situation. We've got inflation that's outstripping wages growth at the moment, which is a you know, has a big political dimension as well as economic one. We're expecting to see forecasts which are pretty rosy in terms of wages and these sorts of things. Are there any on the list of challenges or variables that Josh Frydenberg and Simon Birmingham have to grapple with here that I've left off?
I don't think so, but I think that they're all coalescing into an almost perfect, and I don't mean it ironically, a perfect storm. What is it? Keating said, kicked in the bottom by a rainbow or something. Now, I know that he probably didn't use those words.
I don't think he ever said a bottom.
It sounds odd to say that, right? We listed the pestilence, the floods, war, so on, all of that. The government did something dramatic and unexpected with COVID. It abandoned its back in the black idea, right? And we've talked about this on the podcast before. It flicked the switch to big, big spending. The theory was Matthias Cormann, now the head of the OECD in Paris, the finance minister, spelled it out clearly. The theory was that this would pay for itself, that this massive spending by supporting the economy would boost GDP such that debt to GDP dropped over time, even if you had to borrow to do it. Sort of self-fixing problem. And that's what the figures will show on the budget. So the figures on Tuesday night will show that over a period of years, I'm not quite sure what period of years, it's certainly not in the next 6 or so years, that in the period that's projected, that government debt to GDP, even after all of this borrowing, will be falling. And that's because of what they call in maths the denominator, right? Mm. And GDP will increase for two reasons. Or one of them is more a government revenue thing because of commodity prices going sky high. And here we can, to some extent, thank the war in Ukraine. You know, one of our big commodities is wheat. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Who knows what's going to happen to the price there, but already it's gone up 25%.
And Ukraine's a big wheat producer normally. Yeah.
And well,
Ukraine and Russia together are 39%
of
the world's wheat.
That's right. But we are a big producer. We're about 11% of the world's exported wheat. So big increase in commodity prices, that will boost GDP. The other thing, though, and it sounded fantastical, you know, in the days when Cormann and Frydenberg were talking about it, is that getting down unemployment, no one thought we could get it down to where we are, the budget.
Well, if you close your borders, you can get your unemployment down.
I'll take you up on that in 30 seconds.
Okay.
We'll get down to 3.5%, something like that, unemployment. The budget might even forecast 3.5. It'll certainly forecast 3.75. The theory was that the nice nursery rhyme that you tell your children is that you do this and the government will have more tax revenue, mm-hmm. more people paying tax, of course, they're working, and will be paying out less in benefits. And that's a rosy theory, right? The budget will show that is happening, and it will show projections that show for that reason, that is to say, getting so many people, we've had more than the 370,000 extra people in jobs mm-hmm. in the last year, and no, Mark, that hasn't been because we closed our borders, definitionally. It's so that in itself is fixing this problem, this huge amount of debt. Interest payments on debt will remain lower than they were several years ago because of the low interest rates. And people say, oh, look, rates are going up. Yes, but I get a ping from the Office of Financial Management on my email every day or two when they sell government bonds. And they've been selling some of them for 30 years. So it's locked in low interest rates for the foreseeable, shall we say.
Yeah, some of them. But what proportion of their profile is 30-year bonds?
Oh, the big chunks. The small chunks are the ones they do. Sometimes they do for 3 months, sometimes for 1 year, quite a few for 10 years, because you need flexibility in the small ones. You don't need flexibility in the big ones. So it will show, that the budget will show, very low unemployment with an opening of borders. With that factored in to the forecasts, they do forecasts now for 4 years, it'll show unemployment below 4%. It'll show a payoff from that, plus the embarrassment of riches from iron ore and other commodity prices. Frydenberg will be able to claim he is, no, I won't use the Keating phrase because we'd have to be vegan, you know, bacon, but he will talk about it all coming together. And he has a very good story to tell. Now, he wouldn't have that story to tell, indeed, Were it not for COVID, he would have persisted with back in the black. We wouldn't have had the stimulation. We would have had an unemployment rate where it always was. And he wouldn't be able to do this Houdini, I've escaped from this debt trap I've built. But that's what's happened.
So it's a Keynesian transformation of the budget.
Successful. Now, you know, we don't know what the future will bring, But the future's not what's relevant. And the unexpected is unforecastable. So what's relevant on the budget night is what's forecast. And what's forecast will be rosy. It will show as if it's all paid off, come
together.
But
won't people look at a trillion plus gross debt and say that's astonishing?
There will be a graph in the budget showing debt. Net debt, as a probably gross as well.
Well, they're saying that gross debt
going down.
Yeah, but they're saying that gross debt will peak lower and sooner than has been forecast in the past.
Yeah, and net debt will peak soon. It wasn't forecast to go down in the last budget. It'll actually show it peaking and substantially going down. So for people who care about these things, bother to look at the graphs or look at the details.
And who believe them.
Because
not all of these predictions or projections have been right. I mean, that, for example, the RBA and this is more of an economic parameter, but rather than a budget one.
You're going to mention wages,
I am going to mention wages.
Repeatedly forecasting they'd pick up.
Yeah, repeatedly forecasting and promising every time they'll pick up, and they're being outstripped by inflation. They're currently being outstripped by inflation. Mm. We expect to see a 3.5% wage growth figure projected in this budget.
Yeah, but we're 3.2 at the moment.
Inflation's 3.5, so we're going backwards still.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, no, sorry, we're 2.3. So it's terribly low at the moment, and that would be good.
So
but
I
you're right.
The projection, yeah.
Yeah, but people will, quite rightly
be cynical.
Treat the wage forecast cynically. That's why there's going to be giveaways. I don't know what they're going to be, but the best guess is that it'll be dressed up as something to help people with petrol prices. It won't. The best guess is it won't be a cut in the petrol excise. It will be taking that money, that $8 billion per year from the Lamington low and middle income tax offset, Lamington.
The Lamido, yeah.
Yeah, that one. That is pretty useless in an immediate sense because people get it at the end
of
the financial
year. And they want to get – and this is the other thing,
they'll
Maria.
Bring it forward.
Let me go to Maria on this because this is what I understand to be the case, as Peter is outlining there, that they dumped the low and middle income tax offset, which is this $1,040, I think it was, that an individual would get. But they wouldn't get it to the end of the tax year. They're going to change it. They're going to dump that, but they'll go for a one-off cash payment for low and middle income earners, not for people on welfare, incidentally, but for low and middle income earners, and they'll get it before the election, conveniently.
Which, by the way, is two entire financial years earlier than it would have been paid out if they do it this financial year, which I think they might be minded
to,
Mark.
Well, it raises the question, though, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this, Maria. It raises the question about whether people will buy this in a sort of a buy this in terms of its credibility. Because my understanding is that Labor senior figures are quite confident on this question. They feel like the government suddenly handing out DOSH just before a poll, the people will take it, of course, but they won't be very convinced by it. And, of course, then you've got the whole question about do governments get a bounce from the budget? Everyone talks about budget bounces, but they usually just don't really materialise much.
So I guess I want to know, is this money just going to be inflationary?
Well, that's a risk too, isn't it?
I think that is kind of the sort of big meta story that's going on right now. Like, cost of living really kind of means inflation.
Yeah, this is a different sort of inflation. This isn't really inflation what we've had, right? It's a one-off price rise or a number of one-off price rises, one of them for petrol. That has impoverished people. So this will, if you like, but it's not like prices chasing their own tail or anything. It's like a one-off hit to living standards. It'll be reversed when the oil price eventually reverses.
Hit. Anyway, so can we go back to Maria?
Yeah, but it's sort of reversing. It's not a diabetes-inducing sugar hit. It's reversing a low blood sugar sort of suddenly presented with us by the oil price rise and other things.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, I guess on the question of whether or not people will buy it is, I think the government faces the problem that people, I think, have come to understand that the government no longer really sticks to its rhetoric around, I guess, fiscal rectitude that it used to have, which, we all kind of know was a bit bullshit in the sense that maintaining a budget, like a household budget, is kind of stupid, right? And that it certainly like locked them out of certain opportunities. And Peter was very good at sort of explaining how COVID kind of allowed them to get out of this trap that they had built for themselves rhetorically. But I think they are sort of stuck in a different rhetorical bind, which is, you know, this is a government that has now a solid reputation as being pretty fast and loose with other people's money, i.e. taxpayers' money. And I do think there will be a high degree of cynicism in the community about it, and they might not get the, credit, right, that Peter has sort of said, like, okay, so it's a low blood sugar hit rather than a sugar hit. And I actually do wonder if a lot of people will just – well, essentially view it in the way I did. Like, I'm worried about inflation. Prices seem to be going up. Inflation is running out of control in America. People are talking about wage rises. But if wages kind of go to kind of catch up with cost of living, aren't we going to end up in a wages outbreak? Weren't there 17% interest rates in the 1980s? Like, oh.
Yeah, I remember
that's
them.
Sort of how I think.
Yeah, that's really interesting too, because you get to that question of the consistency of the message or the coherence of the narrative. So the Conservative government, as it is, will want to go to an election banking on its or reaping the dividend of its hard won reputation as you say, Maria, for fiscal rectitude, of being sound economic managers, at the same time as trying to buy their way out of some unpopularity with these gifts. And there is this narrative around about inflation. And if there's a lack of consistency in what it is that you're saying, are people persuaded by it? I mean, no one's going to be sending the checks back. We know that much. But will it be a sugar hit in terms of any popularity they get as well?
I think your concerns may well be right, Maria. I'm just speaking about the set of numbers they'll be able to present. Whether they break through to a population which increasingly sees the Prime Minister as not always up to his word, not always having complete veracity, it might feed into that.
So I think it'll play out. Yeah, that was very diplomatic. So I think there are like potentially some uncertainties in how it will play out, right? So I mean, like, giving people money might just make them feel good. The country's going in the right direction. I doubt it will actually kind of counter like all of this sort of anxiety, right? You know, like, people can't afford houses. Mortgages are about to go up. All of that, right? And I do wonder, I guess, in those constituencies that are already quite concerned about the reliability and trustworthiness of this, of the government, right? You know, the leafy kind of green, the teal seats, the teal independent seats, like, you know, throwing, like, giving out this money might just reinforce that sort of narrative that this is a government that will kind of say or do anything to get reelected. They no longer have their principles. They don't even have this narrative around their, you know, the sort of rock solid economic manager line. You know, we kind of already know that many in the Liberal base are kind of horrified by the amount of spending that they have undertaken, and because it does sort of kind of undermine a sort of core narrative. And so if Labor can paint this spending as reckless, as you say, people will very happily take this money.
Yeah,
they might
Labor's
just save it.
A credibility problem there too. Probably the best thing Labor can do is shut up, because rightly or not, the school halls, the building, the
school
education
halls was
revolution.
A good program. I will not hear a word said about it.
Well, they've left us with a lot of fine school halls.
The ventilation program, and
you know, Labor's got that baggage, hasn't it, in people's minds?
It does.
Yeah, but Rudd won with that statement in 2007, this reckless spending must stop. And it really did burnish his credentials as a new kind of Labor Prime Minister. Now, obviously, the GFC happened shortly afterwards, and, you know, everything changed, but which led to school halls and some other things. But, you know, I think Maria's point is very valid here in terms of the overall reputation that the Conservatives have, that they've essentially thrown up against the wall, really, for the last several years.
Mm.
I think it's just now much more risky for the government And it is a kind of interesting point that you make there, Peter, and Mark too, about Rudd and about the baggage associated, around these Labor spending programs, which we know the waste on, I think the building the education revolution was around 3% of the whole budget, compared to the quote unquote waste of the JobKeeper program, which I think was significantly
13.5 billion, I think, went to companies that were still making a profit.
It's a lot of cash. Yeah, and again, like it's that trade off between how you get this money out. There's always going to be a bit of waste, right? But I guess I do wonder, is this sort of like the 1983 election? You know, people are not necessarily convinced that the country is kind of going in the right direction. The government's the government has not necessarily been able to sort of fulfill its economic rhetoric, right? Like Fraser, was kind of waiting for a mining boom that didn't show up on time, right? And then Labor got elected and the drought broke and, like, you know, the economic sunshine came out, right? He was just very unlucky in his electoral timing. And I do wonder if, like, events are moving so rapidly, you know, that the government's situation has deteriorated so markedly since the beginning of the year for a bunch of acts of God and unforced errors. I just wonder whether or not the reception of delightful handout beforehand will be viewed as without cynicism, I suppose.
It's just another thing that's being thrown at them, another sort of stunt, effectively. Yeah, but an expensive one in this case.
It'll tick every box. It won't be enough, to satisfy everyone, and people will treat the money cynically. My father, by the way, Ross Martin, John Howard sent out those checks to senior citizens. I don't know why, just because they were senior citizens before the election.
I'd say because they were voters, yeah.
And my father was of the view that he didn't need the check, so he sent his to Maxine McHugh, or he sent her a donation with a card saying, get rid of this man. What's he doing sending me money?
It seemed to work.
It did. So, people might treat it badly, but if you look at what the government, there's only some things the government can do, and I think the budget will enable it to do in every way to use the best hand it's got. It can't not give people relief, right?
Yeah.
These people are justly screaming about, petrol prices, what, up from 160 at the beginning of the year? Yeah, up from 160 at the beginning of the year to about 220,
Well, that's the trouble, though. It's going to be a hamburger and a fuel tank, as I made the point the other day. I mean, or a few fuel tanks and then it's gone. And here's my prediction about it. The budget will be, for reasons you've said, probably quite well received. The government's had plenty of time to think about it, and it has some favourable conditions to play with here. Whether it will change the political calculus or not, I think, is far less certain. I suspect not. Most budgets don't. And 2 weeks after the budget, we'll be in an election campaign, and I don't think people will be voters. I mean, politicians might be, but I don't think voters will be talking about the budget. They'll just be talking about the uncertainty in the uncertain environment in which the budget has been framed and in which we're having an election
I think there's only one budget that's actually really affected people, and I'm wondering whether you can think of the same one as me, Mark. In terms of actually making a difference in how people thought. Maria?
2001?
It's recent.
Oh. It was a 2014 budget.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yes.
That was when Joe Hockey decided to fix things. Yeah. Boy, did he fix things.
Well,
people were going to retire later. Pension was only going to be indexed miserly. He fixed, you're going to have to wait forever for an unemployment benefit. He fixed things.
And people noticed. They proudly announced they were cutting $80 billion out of health and education. I remember I ran with that as the lead of my coverage.
That, by the way, was not something that everyone noticed. And you did on the night. It turned out to be the big thing. That was an extraordinary budget. That, had there been an election, it would have made a big difference. But yes, I agree. It's more a case of not making mistakes. And I think you're right, Maria. I'm certain that people won't be talking about the budget, in 6 weeks' time or whenever, when there's the election.
We're just at time now. So, look, I think we might leave it there. There were so many other things that we could cover. We'll have to come back, obviously, and we'll be talking about the budget next week once we've actually seen it and some other things. And there's going to be a lot of election talk, a lot of opinions to be exchanged about what's going to turn this election one way or the other. I'll leave you with this thought, and I'll take a response from both of you. I suspect the women of Australia are the big sort of sleepers in this election, and many of them have already made up their minds.
I've nothing to say to that other than certainly the candidates who are the ones who will take seats away from the government, if that happens, are women. And it used to be a truism. Dean Jentsch, who died this year, was my politics tutor at university. And he told us in, I think the first class, certainly in first year at Flinders Uni, he said, women don't vote for women. And I don't think that's true anymore. I think that's,
it
mustn't be true because there are so many women standing. Presumably, the people who are backing them have chosen them precisely because they think women will vote for women.
Yeah, that's definitely changed historically, and yes, I do think the women's vote will be important because the issues in focus recently have all been about the role of government, and that is, I think, an issue that really does impact women, and women have come to kind of understand that in a new way, and that probably reflects why across the world we see that women have gone from voting for conservative parties because they were afraid of radical Labor governments who might do crazy things to now voting for social democratic parties because they support services that women disproportionately rely on because they ultimately organise their children's lives.
And we can thank South Australia, of course. Without women mightn't have voted.
They'll also, and I've spoken...
At least not a seat.
Many have said to me, and I take this as an important detail, that they'll also have just been watching Scott Morrison, watching the way he handles blame when there's blame to be accepted, watching the way he handles conversations, looking at his language in a number of crises. And I think this is, let's just put it this way. We have a secret ballot in this country, and I think there'll be a number of people who might be changing their vote. We shall see, of course. That's Democracy Sausage for this week. Peter Martin, Maria Tafaga, thanks very much again for being here.
Pleasure.
Pleasure.
And we'll talk next week, as I say, probably all things budget again. Bye for now.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.